And joining me now in the studio is Dr. Gregory Eastwood from Upstate Center for Bioethics and Humanities, my co-host for our monthly ethics conversations. Good morning, Dr. Eastwood.
Good morning, Tricia.
It's great to see you. Hope you're enjoying your summer.
Oh, I'm having a great time.
That's great. And we have an interesting topic this morning.
We do. We're going to talk about religious beliefs and healthcare.
It seems like a great conversation for a Sunday morning, doesn't it?
Yes.
I'm actually kind of surprised we haven't had this conversation before, and we have a wonderful guest who listeners will find very familiar. Will you introduce her to us?
Well, she's no stranger to your program.
Not at all.
No stranger to me, too. I've known Reverend Terry Culbertson for a number of years and worked closely with her on a number of things at University Hospital. Reverend Culbertson is the manager of the Center for Spiritual Care at University Hospital.
Good morning and welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. And Dr. Eastwood, you're going to start us off this morning with a story.
This story is a dramatic example of how religion and religious beliefs can affect healthcare. The listeners may remember this story of appearing in the paper and on the various media last year. On Easter Sunday 2008 in Wausau, Wisconsin, Madeline Newman, 11-year-old girl, died of diabetic ketoacidosis. That's a severe complication of diabetes. Her parents, Lelaney and Dale Newman, believed in the power of prayer, and they did not seek medical help when most observers thought that was indicated. And they were charged with reckless homicide in Madeline's death, and they were eventually convicted. During the trial, the father testified, "If I go to the doctor, I am putting the doctor before God." As I say, they were convicted and they were sentenced to serve 1 month a year in jail for 6 years. So that is 6 months in jail plus 10 years probation. And at the sentencing, the judge told the parents, "God probably works through other people, some of them doctors." So this is an example, a dramatic example. Maybe the listeners can't relate personally to this, but I think you all have opinions about this situation.
Absolutely true. You know, I remember reading about this, and we've read over time of other children who have passed away when parents have made decisions, and I think we all sit in judgment of what those decisions might be. Is it a decision we ever could have made? I tend to think I'm more like the mama lion. Anything anybody can do to help my children is what I want them to do. But Reverend Culbertson, do you run into people who make decisions in different ways because of their religious beliefs or their spiritual beliefs?
Absolutely, and whether it's a child or whether it's themselves. Actually, the newspaper today had a story about the former president of LeMoyne, and who was making a healthcare choice regarding his end-stage cancer, where he said, "I don't think I want to pursue any additional treatment." Basically, out of his faith and belief in that he'll, you know, be with the Lord in heaven, looking forward to that rather than the suffering of this earth.
Well, you know, it sort of begs the question, if I'm talking about a religion versus a spiritual belief. And Dr. Eastwood, one of the things about this particular story is that there could not be, or we've not been able to identify a specific religion, formal religion, that these people belong to. How does that play into something like this?
Well, I think it underscores the unique nature of every one of us as a human being. And even though we are part of a recognized religion, I think each of us comes to life, and in particular healthcare situations, with our own take on that religion, our own beliefs. And it's not just the religion that we identify with that affects us or influences us, but it's our culture, it's our spirituality in other sense. So it's a complex but very unique situation for each of us.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Culbertson, I happen to think that there's a big difference between religion and spirituality, and certainly then culture is almost separate from that, even though they all play together. So give us some sense of the differences, if you will.
Yeah, actually, I would hesitate to make them that different. I think you could look at maybe a thought of overlapping circles.
Okay.
Where they intersect. Spirituality, one way to draw that in your brain or your mind might be a larger circle that encompasses one's faith practice or religion that's identified in the culture, such as a church or a denomination. But spirituality could include other things that give meaning, such as your family and nature and golf, for example.
There you go.
Yes.
Thank you for the golf reference there.
You're welcome.
Well, I actually think of religion as being far more organized
Yes.
Four more. And I think you used the word earlier, community. So speak to that.
Community and the actual definition, Wilfred Cantwell Smith talks about it, essentially being codified beliefs that are practiced in community.
Written down somewhere.
Yes, exactly. Doctrines that come out in architect and music and doctrinal statements and creeds and all those things. So an overt expression of a spirituality that, I guess you could say spirituality, therefore, is a little more internal, perhaps, more individual.
Well, yeah. How do we, and Dr. Eastwood, you'll have some of the answer to this, Reverend Culbertson, I expect you'll have a little bit difference. How do we look at this in the framework of accessing care? Now, specifically today, I think we're trying to focus on what happens in a hospital. Mm. But people are admitted to the hospital. How do they let somebody know what their religion is, perhaps, or their spirituality? And then how does that play out during their hospital experience?
Well, there's a formal mechanism of that Reverend Culbertson was talking about earlier. Maybe, Terry, you can expound on that.
Surely. Well, the Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals for most hospitals in America right now, requires there to be some kind of initial inquiry into one's spiritual practice or beliefs.
So, like on my admission form?
Well, it would be more what the initial nursing assessment would ask you, such as, Tricia, do you have any particular beliefs or practices spiritually that will infect or we can help you with in your, while you're here in the hospital?
Right, and then I tell you I'm Protestant. But, you know, Protestant
is pretty broad,
huge, and I'm not sure that everybody among all the different Protestant religions believes the same thing.
And actually, most hospitals would also ask you your religion or your faith tradition and put that down as part of your admission note. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of joking about that, but they allow you about three letters.
Three letters.
Three letters.
Okay,
so
P-R-O. It says I'm pro-religion, I guess,
pro-religion,
right?
Pro-religion, right?
All right. But there have got to be some really unique ones. There have got to be some of the religions that are not as mainstream, I would say, as Protestant or Catholicism or even Jewish religions. There have got to be religions such as Jehovah's Witnesses, where there are a little bit different beliefs in the kinds of medical care they can receive. I want to talk about that, explore it a little bit more. We do need to take a break right now. When we come back, let's talk about those different religions and then how they're regarded in the hospital setting, how that carries out for a patient who's in the hospital. So listeners, we're going to be back in just a few moments. This is Upstate's HealthLink on air on 570 WSYR. Well, welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. This is your host, Tricia Torrey, Every Patient's Advocate, along with my co-host for our monthly ethics conversations, Dr. Gregory Eastwood from Upstate Center for Bioethics and Humanities, and our guest for this morning's conversation on religion and medical care, Reverend Terry Culbertson, also from Upstate Spiritual Care Department. You're an official department
That's
great. As we went to the break, we were getting ready to talk about different religions and how they are regarded in a hospital setting. And Dr. Eastwood, you had many, many years working in hospitals. Have you seen an evolution, perhaps, in religion and how it's regarded?
I think the evolution has been one of more tolerance and understanding of the various beliefs and practices. You know, we all have, even if we don't identify ourselves as being religious, most people do, but some don't, we do have beliefs that affect healthcare. But there are some religions, such as Jehovah's Witnesses, mm-hmm. where there are specific beliefs mm-hmm. that sometimes are problematic for physicians and nurses and others involved in the healthcare team.
Physicians and nurses who want to be able to do everything they know how to do.
That's right.
But then are precluded from doing some of it because of rules within the religion.
To be specific,
yes.
There are conditions where we think blood transfusion is indicated to treat the patient, maybe even save the patient's life. Mm-hmm. And as most of us know, Jehovah's Witnesses feel that a blood transfusion, based upon their interpretation of Scripture, is not appropriate. In fact, may even condemn that person to eternal damnation.
That's right.
Wow.
That is severe. So we need to get around that and deal with that. One way of getting around that is that there are very elegant techniques developed now, so-called bloodless or minimal blood loss surgery, Of course, it puts the patient a little bit at higher risk, but not too much. There are blood substitutes that are sometimes available.
And so the substitute would be okay, but the real blood would not?
That's the case.
Interesting.
In my understanding. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, these are chemical substitutes or developed substitutes. Also, from a legal point of view, any Jehovah's Witness who is an adult, that means 18 or over, and has the mental capacity to make decisions for him or herself, is deemed to refuse this treatment. All of us can refuse if we're in that condition.
Sure.
And so, sometimes the physicians feel, well, they're making the wrong decision, but that's the decision that's right for them.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to children of Jehovah's Witnesses, it's not so clear-cut as that. The courts have said that children are not necessarily bound by the decisions of their parents. And in this particular instance, the courts have generally ruled that you can give blood transfusions to children of Jehovah's Witnesses.
That would kind of go back to that first story that we started with, yeah. with the child who died and the judge coming back and saying, you cannot use your child as a martyr. This is the court saying that this is a decision that needs to be made on behalf of the child without regard to the religion, I guess. Yes, is the way you're describing
it. Without regard.
Are there other religions that we should be aware of? I think back, my great-grandmother was a Christian Science reader.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how that affected her choices of health care. I was way too young when she passed away. And I asked my dad, and he doesn't really remember either, because he doesn't ever remember his grandmother ever being hospitalized, certainly. And in those days, I mean, she passed away back in the 1950s, not so much. Uh-huh. So what do Christian Scientists believe in those terms? Do we know?
Well, my understanding of Christian Science beliefs is that they respect the work of medical practitioners, but feel that sickness and other kinds of illness is the result of sin and of ignorance, perhaps. I think it's highly individual within Christian Science practitioners as to whether to avoid medical care or to seek medical care under certain conditions. Terry, you've had some experience with this, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, I think some have done it in conjunction with the practitioner who comes and is also part of the healing modality for that person.
And, that's a great segue into really the next part of our conversation, which is, all right, now I'm in the hospital. I need a certain form of treatment. I may have a religious belief for it, against it, ambivalent. But at what point do I have that conversation, or at what point is the practitioner, the doctor, the nurse, whomever it's going to be, at what point does that conversation take place? And do you get called in, Reverend Culbertson, to sort of negotiate what that might be?
Yeah, I think myself and my chaplains, we have that discussion all the time. And sometimes it's beliefs that people have held that may be based on a lot of things that are connected to a traditional religion or not. I'll never forget the time I was called in. A young man was quite upset. His significant other was going to have a C-section for her pregnancy. She was in distress, and he said, she can't have one. I'm a Baptist.
Oh.
And I said, well, tell me about your belief. He said, well, my grandmother said that it was wrong. And he connected that with her being Baptist, but there's nothing in Baptist theology that would prohibit a C-section.
And that kind of begs the question. As I said, I'm Protestant. I belong to a formal church, and there are some beliefs that I have that are opposite that formal church, even though I identify with that church. So to what point do you say that it's actually somebody's religious belief versus a belief that may not be? Do you respect the belief by itself, or do you respect the rules of the religion?
Well, I think you bring up an interesting point, Tricia, that sometimes beliefs are personally held without necessarily examining whether they coincide with the beliefs of the larger religious community. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the beliefs are held because they do coincide. So maybe one message to our listeners is to examine this for yourself.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with having beliefs that, like you, Tricia, might differ a little bit from your faith community.
Right.
But as long as you understand that and maybe examine whether this might someday be relevant to the situation when you when you're a patient.
It makes me think a little bit of the conscientious objector status back in the 60s when, our friends were being recruited to fight in Vietnam and be recruited to the armed services. And there were people who took conscientious objector. And I don't know. maybe you know, Reverend Culbertson, whether that was a specific, you adhered to a certain religious belief, or was it your own belief? It's, I'm just throwing it out. I don't know.
No, I think it was a little bit of both. I think the difference there wasn't recruited as much as drafted.
Well, that's what I mean. Yes, you're right. You're right. Drafted is definitely the word. But, you know, and I'll share a little bit of my own story. As many of our listeners know, I went through a misdiagnosis of a terminal cancer in the summer of 2004. Now, I had been church-going for much of my life, and certainly I'm somebody who prays on a regular occasion, a regular basis. But during that crisis in my life, my spiritual beliefs, much more so than my religious beliefs, really coalesced into something that for the first time in my life I could articulate and could articulate without question. Mm-hmm. And I have to wonder, Reverend, is this something that is unusual? I can't think it is. I think it's probably very usual. And is that something that you then run into when you're in the hospital for the first time, people actually being able to talk about what their belief systems are, because it's a crisis?
That's exactly right. I mean, there's an old adage about, you know, we don't know our faith until it's like a tea bag that's put in hot water. Does it actually work?
Interesting.
So there's that, sort of that image of the crisis is what precipitates our looking at our faith and the asking of questions such as why is this, and what does my faith uphold or not uphold, and what I'm going through,
and does it really matter whether or not your formal religion or your formal the organized religion you belong to, does it matter if it's different once you're in that hospital and decisions are being made for you? Dr. Eastwood, is that, you know, if I say to somebody I'm a Jehovah's Witness, as opposed to I'm a Methodist and I don't want a blood transfusion, can I still make the same kinds of decisions?
Well, most people in the hospital know what it means to be a Jehovah's Witness because, you know, we've been all trained and we are prepared.
And that's really my question, yeah. And I didn't ask it the right way.
Somebody who's a Methodist and says, I don't believe in blood transfusions, someone might take a double take. But the underlying fact and the legal ruling here is that if you're an adult and you have the mental capacity to make your own decisions, you can make whatever decision you want. You can refuse medical treatment of any sort if you're a competent adult. The converse actually is not the case. You cannot demand specific medical treatments, because particularly if they're not medically indicated. But you certainly have the prerogative of refusing medical treatment as an adult.
It's interesting because for the first time, I hear something that actually might be related to a money question. I can't demand a certain kind of treatment, but why not?
Well, that gets into medical judgment.
Yeah.
And I think you could sort of imagine what might happen if patients willy-nilly demand all kinds of medical treatment. So, you know, that may be the subject for another Sunday's discussion.
Maybe it is.
Because it's huge, but it's relevant to this, I know.
Absolutely.
And I just wanted to segue a comment also that I think for some traditions, making particular decisions will not separate you from your religious community, but some would.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so I think for some of us, like you mentioned, sort of you're a broad Methodist.
Yeah.
It wouldn't separate you if you made a choice, say, like to have no blood transfusions. Well, for a Jehovah's Witness, that's part and parcel of their belief system.
Ah, yes, and therefore they would be separated
from
their
faith
formal
community.
Religion.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah,
you know,
very much so.
That's a great place to take a break. When we come back, we'll pick this up. I think we're getting into the real heart of the matter here. So listeners, if you will stay with us for just a few moments, this is Upstate's Health Link On Air on 570 WSYR.